Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for listening to The Art of Image. I'm Dan Phillips. This program is focused on personal image development. These shows will discuss topics ranging from custom tailoring to business attire to communication and everything in between. Stay tuned. This is The Art of Image.
Thanks for joining us here in San Francisco. You're listening to The Art of Image with Parker Geiger and myself, Dan Phillips. Parker, are you there?
I am here. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Today's a really rainy morning, which is not unusual, I guess, for this time of the year here in San Francisco. But how are things there in Atlanta?
Cold. You know, I remember when we spoke around Thanksgiving, it was down in the 40s, like high 40s. Been about average 15 degrees this past week pretty consistently, and we had some slight snow in the city area, just flurries and stuff. It didn't really stick a whole lot, but in the suburbs, I think it was a couple nights ago, it got so bad we had over 1,000 accidents in about a 2 or 3 hour window period, just because people aren't used to driving on ice, you know.
Wow. I mean, what is 15 degrees feel like? The coldest I think I've been in is like, you know, 45 degrees here, and I think that's cold.
Well, it got to a zero. It got to zero chill factor with the wind factor, and it was as cold. I was downtown at a meeting at the Chamber of Commerce this week, and it was as cold as it is in New York. That's how cold it was, and that's unusual. But we actually had our lowest low in history this week. But it's pretty bone-chilling with the weather, with the wind blowing. It's pretty cold. You need scarves. We're not equipped with that down here as much as they are in New York. How was your week?
My week is going great. And actually, it's been terrific here. The sponsor of the show, LT Bodrix, the clothing designing company, actually has come up with a new product. And I just wanted to make a brief announcement on that.
Yeah.
And that they've put out. They've elevated. This is something we've talked about women's accessories in the past, and they've just recently put out a product which has elevated the woman's headband to a very high degree. I mean, they've made it just something so fantastic. It's and so I just wanted to make mention of that. It's an exciting new product. You'll find it in most of the stores here in San Francisco, most of the women's boutiques here in San Francisco. But that was one of the exciting things that happened to me this week. And the other thing that I wanted to talk about was emotional intelligence, and I have a report on that to talk about. And I think the more I learn about emotional intelligence and what it means, and the more I think I want to take the show in that direction. And I know you obviously have, that's a part of what you do as well with the Shuva Group.
Yeah, emotional intelligence, you know, it's they finally got it. You know, we've been doing this for many, many years, and emotional intelligence, everybody has, they just kind of coined it. And Daniel Goleman wrote a book in 1995, and I forgot the name of it. I want to call it Work with Emotional Intelligence in the Workplace.
Actually, you know, I'm reading it right now. It's called Emotional Intelligence.
He had two now, but I think the one he really kind of came to fruition with was the one in 95. Now since then, since the book was actually written, they've kind of streamlined a little bit more. They used to have 6 or 8 steps. I forgot what it was, but now it's like 4. And it's a very interesting book. But the way it all came about is that they went out and really measured to see if everybody with a high IQ were highly successful, because that's what they did. The IQ test, intelligent test, was to, if you were highly intelligent, then you were going to be highly successful. What they found out was highly intelligent people weren't necessarily highly successful. Those with an average IQ were highly successful. And what they found out across the world, across the continents and across different type of work environments and different levels of positions, that if a person possessed emotional intelligence, they were 2 times more likely successful than those without it. I mean, think about it. Wouldn't it be great just to really tell people at work what's on your mind?
Oh, yeah.
Right. But you can't. And why not? Because it's not politically correct. You can't do that. You can't get things done. And so it's how you treat people. And you can. It doesn't mean – a lot of people think emotional intelligence is being nice all the time. That's not true either. It's not about being nice. It's about how you say things and how you approach people to get things done. And a lot of people, when you look at their behaviors and values, if they're a high-energy person, it's like boom, 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 boom. They don't stop to think.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's and there's a lot of assessments that are out there on the marketplace now. A lot of people jump on the bandwagon with it, which is great because a lot of people need to be made aware of it. And it is all about awareness. It's, you know,
yeah.
The first step is just being aware.
Yeah. And that takes me to a report, really, that I found this week on emotional intelligence. And the report was written by Dr. Jill Amon Wexler, the renowned brain researcher, which I think that name is really familiar with a lot of people. But in any case, mm-hmm. it's a short report, and basically she wrote it, and essentially it goes like this: want productivity and success in the business world, or are you seeking to build your own financial freedom? Recent studies prove that your emotional intelligence and related confidence and self-esteem are more important brain power than the IQ of your mind. The concept of EQ, emotional intelligence, is having quite an impact on the business and corporate world today. Researchers report that those with strong emotional intelligence have more productivity, creativity, self-esteem, and self-confidence, and make more effective business leaders. Such leaders have more success rising to the top and achieving financial freedom more than those with only a high IQ. What is EQ? Emotional intelligence includes competency in such traits as optimism, effective productivity, self-esteem, motivation, empathy, and personal interaction skills. Your EQ affects almost everything you do. Even while working in a solitary setting, the quality of your work is determined by your self-esteem and self-confidence. That's one aspect of EQ.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the good news. While the IQ of your mind is relatively fixed, your emotional intelligence can be built. Many companies are bringing in psychologists and coaches to improve their top executives' EQ. A well-developed EQ allows a leader to restrain less productive feelings, anger, and self-doubt, and focus on goals with more positive feelings, self-confidence, and open communication. The result is a higher team productivity, and in the case of the independent entrepreneur, a higher probability of achieving true financial freedom. Worldwide studies find those with high EQ tend to have more success rising to the top of corporations. The higher people move up in a company, the more critical EQ becomes.
Yeah.
Women and men have equal EQ, but tend to be strong in different areas. Women score high in empathy and social responsibility, while men score high in stress, tolerance, and self-confidence. And so I wanted to bring that, share that to light, and wanted to get your opinion about that.
I don't know if you remember us talking about the VIP model, success potential model. Did I lose you? I'm hearing background noise. Is that?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Are we connected? That's okay. Are we connected?
Yes.
Oh, I thought I lost you. I'm sorry. I think that that the VIP model, which is visibility, image, and performance, and I said 10% is performance, 30% is image, 60% visibility, and I said success potential, not success. So to be successful, you have to perform. You always have to stay status quo, but to move beyond that, that's where you bring in emotional intelligence, and that's where the visibility is. The more you're out there working with people, if you were stuck inside a closet with the door shut all day long working, it wouldn't be an issue. But that's not the reality of what's going on there today. I had a conversation with one of my clients for many years, and she was one of the highest ranking women within this industry she worked within. And I asked her just the other day, last Sunday actually, we were talking. I said, what's some of the biggest mistakes you feel like you made in your career? If you could go back when, 15 years ago or 10 years ago, what were some things you would change? She said, I would have been more politically correct. Because she's a woman working in an all-man's world, and as much as they like women to have opinions, I think it held her back because they weren't used to that. And if she'd been more politically correct, more emotionally intelligent, and not said what comes off the top of her mind, I think she would have probably gone further that organization.
Sure. Now, Bell Parker, as you know, this show is all about, giving people the skills or helping them with tools that can help build some of these aspects of the personality. And I wanted to know, and I think this is something that is true. I hope you do have. Is there something available to them that maybe they can go to your website and download some tools on emotional intelligence that they can start to look at?
There's a couple of assessments that people can do. They call us because they're not our assessments. We have to pay for the assessments. There are probably some on the internet that are out there, but I don't know enough about other assessments to know how valid they are. I do think that it's becoming more narrow scoped, where what's out there is really strong and does measure certain things. But if they do some research, they can send me an email. I can send them some information about that, easily do that. Because there's a lot of different competencies within emotional intelligence. It can get pretty comprehensive and complex, but it can also be very easily understood. She's right on when she says that the IQ is something you can't really change, but the EQ you can. And the research I've done, definitely men have different strengths than women do, which makes sense by nature. But it's pretty fascinating stuff to me. I just had a meeting this past week, actually, with one of our coaches, and there is a new product on the market coming out, not on the market yet, that measures emotional intelligence, and it's one of probably the best ones on the market. So that should be coming out after the 1st of January.
Oh, great. Yeah, look forward to checking that out. Please let us know when that develops, and we'll take a look at that, too.
I think with our guest today, we should talk about how can one show emotional intelligence in their resume, their cover letter, or, how would they show that during an interview process? I think that would be some interesting questions to bring up.
Oh, absolutely. That's a great tie-in, sure. And as a matter of fact, before we get to the guest, I wanted to give a little background on the guest today. His name is Paul Freiberger, and he's the president and CEO of a company called Shimmering Resume, located here in San Mateo, California. But Paul Freiberger, has also been an award-winning author, and he's written several books, one of which I've seen the movie, and I did read the book a while ago. It's called Fire in the Valley. And that book became, a movie called
The Pirates of Silicon Valley.
The Pirates of Silicon Valley, exactly.
Yeah.
But I just thought that was just an interesting idea to have. The thing is, I have a personal experience with Paul's resume writing ability. I mean, in my career, in schools, helping graduates, find jobs and getting them prepared with their resumes and so on. I have a good deal of experience in writing resumes myself. But when it came to writing my own resume, it's like if you're a doctor, you're not going to operate on yourself. So you go to another doctor to have that work done. So that's how I got to know Paul and. Exceptional writing and resume work, I have to say. Absolutely the best. So from personal experience, I thought I'd bring him on the program.
That's awesome. Let's talk to him.
Yes. Now before we bring him on the air, I did get an email from our previous show. And that was a show that we did on Laban. Karen Studd. Yeah, with a movement analyst.
That seems like months ago.
It does, doesn't it?
It does.
But in any case, here it goes. It says, hi, Dan and Parker. On last week's program, the show topic was all about body language and presentation. At my present new job, of which I've only been working at for 2 months, I've just discovered that I'm going to need to start giving public presentations in front of large audiences. This is not something I have ever done, nor am I prepared to do. And to be honest, I'm absolutely terrified. How do I maintain composure and not look lost? If you could talk a little bit about this on your next show, that would be great. Much appreciated. And that was from Robert.
Well, there's a lot of little things that a person can do. I think there's two things that, you know, to hit on is that, remember, it's all about projecting confidence. I think the biggest mistake that I've seen in my career working with individuals that do it every day and that do it once a year is that they don't know how to open their presentation. So they start out really shaky. They'll stand up and say, you know, thank you so much for me being here, blah, 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 and everybody's asleep in the first 30 seconds. You got a few seconds to get people's attention. And so what you want to do is take a look at the content. Most people know their content, unless it's written for them. And even if it's written for them, they should take ownership of the content, because only then will your body language project that naturally and more naturally to you as the person delivering it. But if they come up with a strong opening and make it relevant to the topic as well as to the audience, that will take away a lot of their fears. For example, I think there's five or six that we options we give people. One is a declarative statement, statistics, a rhetorical question, a rhetorical statement. I even added Aesop's fables because it makes it a story. It's not a personal story. Because stories are the ones, is another option, and a story is really great to do. So if they go to aesopfables.com, there are tons of topics, like, I don't know, 1,000 of them. So you can make it and relate it. So if you don't have your own personal story to tell, which people love the personal stories, you can use a fable. It's not a joke.
Oh.
You don't tell jokes. But I've done
I've used
fables with a lot of my clients, and they love that because it brought everybody in. It's like, okay, how does this relate to me? When I do presentation skills, when I stand up to present to the class, I'll say, if public speaking has become a person's number one fear of death, why would anybody want to use it or learn how to do it? And they're sitting there going, yeah, why am I here? Why do I have to do this? You know, so I've got them interested, and then I answer the question. Because today's professionals have to be multifaceted. They've got to be able to communicate who they are and what they know to an audience at different periods of time and different groups and audiences. So it gets them involved. Then you start bringing it in. I think the second thing is having a great closing. You know, the same thing. Use the same, you know, questions, personal story, Aesop's fable. Even let the program, how it evolved, your closing may change. But have a good, strong, I call it the opening statement and closing argument in a court. You got to get you got to get the juror's attention right away, and sometimes you may lose them, but you got to get them back on your side. You know,
and you're saying there's a website called aesopsfables.com. They can go there and get some of these stories that they can incorporate into their talks.
Exactly, and it's brilliant. I found some on there that I've been using in my coaching sessions, and it's just been amazing. And people really relate to that, and it gives them a strong opening. I think, like I said, I think most people, if they really have a strong opening and are confident with that, that's going to take away a lot of their fears.
Wonderful. Absolutely great. Now, let's introduce our guest for the program today, and his name is Paul Freiberger. Are you there?
Hi there. I'm here. This is Paul.
Hey,
Paul.
Hey, Paul.
How's everything going? How is it out there in San Mateo today?
Well, it's rainy, but we're doing fine, thanks. Looking forward to talking to you guys.
Great. Well, Paul, could you tell us a little bit about your background and how you started working as a resume writer, and just give us some information about, you know, yourself and what you do for people out there.
Sure. I'll tell you really quickly, and then I can address questions you have, because I'm sure that's really where I can add some value for your listeners. My company is called Shimmering Resumes, and what I do at Shimmering Resumes is to really try to make your background, no matter whose background it is, shine and sparkle in a way that people are not used to on paper. My goal always is to make you feel like you're the most qualified person on paper, because it's the paper that gets in front of the hiring manager. And so the first thing that you've got to do, even if you know you're qualified, is look qualified on paper. You know, you've got the most qualified people in the world, and if they have a lousy resume, unfortunately, they're never going to make progress. So what I use is my writing skills as a veteran newspaper reporter for many years and an author of a number of books. I found that I was helping a lot of friends develop good resumes, and so I finally decided to turn that into a business. And so with Shimmering Resumes, I counsel my clients on their careers, on what kind of a job they might want to look for. I help them develop a resume. I help them with job interview preparation. And I help them with a good job search strategy, because having a good resume is a start, and it's a good start. But you really need more than a resume. You need a strategy to find a job nowadays, especially in this economic malaise that we've all been experiencing. So that's really a bit of a summary of my business, Shimmering Resumes. But I'd love to answer any questions I have that might help some of your listeners out there with their resume or job search.
Sure.
One just came to me right away. You're talking about the keywords and things like that. What do you think is happening now in terms of computers reading the resume? How does that affect how you write that resume if just computers are stand searching it for that? Do you find that to be common practice still?
You know, what I find is that it frightens people. You know, I have a lot of clients who come to me, and they're fearful of the fact that their background is going to be read by a computer, and their possibilities of getting a job or getting an interview is going to be determined by a computer. And from my perspective, when you take that approach, you're making a fundamental mistake. Because if you worry about that, you're worrying about the wrong problem. You're not likely to get a job simply by submitting your resume to a job listing. So the intelligent approach is to develop a really strong resume, and if you do that, you're going to naturally deal with the keywords that are most important. And while on the other hand, if you exclusively focus your efforts on highlighting keywords, your resume is going to sound muddy, it's not going to sound intelligent, and then even if a computer likes it, an individual hiring manager is going to look at it and not be very impressed. So the right approach is to really develop the strongest resume you can to really make your background and make you look qualified, and then bundle that effort along with a terrific job search strategy. So you need to you can't just develop a resume and send it out into the computer sphere and expect to get hired. What you need to do is develop a great resume and then utilize a strategy, frequently including networking and social networking of all sorts, to get that resume in front of the right people. So I find that over-worrying about keywords can just get you in trouble.
Mm. Interesting. Very interesting.
And I have one here. Paul, you know, nowadays many companies are hiring employees as contractors, and they're not even being hired directly by that employer, but through an outside agency that employs them and actually pays them. And, you know, for in a case like this, how does one, put that down on a resume, you know? How do they, and then also, you know, handling that on an application as well?
Mm-hmm. Well, the important thing on the resume is to show what you've done and for whom you've done it. The fact that you may be working for a tremendous company, a really terrific company, but you were hired by an outside agency, will not stop, should not stop you from indicating on your resume that you've been doing work for this company. You can also mention, to be honest on the resume, you can mention that you were contracted through an agency or what have you, but somebody reading the resume is still going to realize that you've been doing this great work for the company that you name. So you don't need to feel embarrassed about the fact that you may have been hired by an agency. On the other hand, it's also an opportunity. If you're working at a great company, even though you were hired by an agency, you're getting a chance to show your talents to that company. And frequently, or often enough anyway, that'll be an entree to get a full-time job at that company. So don't be reluctant to work through an agency if that's where you find an opportunity.
So let me ask you this, and Dan, this is a great question, because a good friend of mine just took on a job, was hired by an organization to actually, the company has a contract with Google, and she's a photographer. And so what she does is that they go into businesses, and they've got it down to a science. They go in, they take shots at a certain degree because the computer puts everything together, but she's not working for the company, but her client is Google that she works for.
Mm-hmm.
So when to position that on her resume, she can't say she works for Google. How would she go about doing something like that? Did they say, I worked for so-and-so, one of my clients was Google? I mean, how would you position something like that? That's kind of tricky.
Yeah. I mean, I would find, unless she's forbidden to mention Google, unless she has signed some sort of non-disclosure agreement where she's not allowed to mention the name of the company, then by all means, I would find a way to convey to the reader that she's done work for Google in one way, shape, or form. And that's all that matters to the reader. The reader will realize, hey, this person, whether she's working directly for Google or through another contractor, her work is clearly good enough to be used by this noteworthy company. And that's the key thing.
Interesting. That's good to know. I'll definitely make sure she listens to this broadcast.
Of course he is. Everybody is.
Now, due to the tight job market right now, Paul, would you suggest that people ought to supplement their resumes with a portfolio listing their skills, experiences, and qualifications that they might not have otherwise placed on their resume due to the standard length limitations of a resume?
Probably not. You know, it's a really good question, because what you're asking addresses the difficult economic environment we're all facing, and this has forced people to kind of feel desperate sometimes, and sometimes it forces people to do things that won't necessarily be in their best interest. Instead, what I really urge people to do is to do the best resume possible, to stick with what works. Now, the problem is that because of the tough economic climate, people tend to have low morale these days, and this forces them, or in a sense, it puts them in a position of feeling kind of down in the dumps, and it prevents them from following through on what they can do best, such as networking. Now, really, the key thing is to get a really good resume and develop a job search strategy that has you out in the field talking to people, developing contacts, and getting that good resume in front of people. Now, no matter how long your resume might be, no matter how many pictures or portfolios you attach to it, if you're not networking and getting it in front of the right people, you're not going to get hired. So develop a good, standard, professional resume, not something that's going to look odd or peculiar or different from what is professional, but do a really good job on your resume and then get an expert networking strategy going and make yourself follow through on it. Set up a plan for yourself. That's what can work.
You know, I've got another follow-up with that one, Dan. You know, years ago when they did resumes, they package them fancy and color, and you know, I remember one young lady at a career fair in the early 90s. I mean, she had spent so much money on this, and I remember the this was when computers were first coming out. And I remember the comments of the people there going, "Wow, what a waste of money!" You know, what do you suggest now for people how to present their resume in terms of when they hand deliver it? Do you recommend doing something more creatively or just keeping it really simple?
I recommend keeping it really professional. And so you need your resume to help you put your best foot forward. So your resume needs to be extremely well written. When you think about all the aspects of a resume, what kind of paper it's on, what color ink is used, those kinds of things. You know, not that those things don't matter, but ask yourself, what's more important, the color of the paper or the quality of the writing? And it's really the writing quality that matters. You need a resume so that when that resume is finally in front of the right person, if it's not a great resume, it's not well written, then you're going to lose out. So you need that resume to be so effective that when someone looks at it and gives it the one-minute scan that you typically get from a person, because that's all the time you're going to get, at least initially, that resume needs to immediately convey that you are the most qualified person on paper. And so I better darn well meet you because I want the best qualified person. So I'm going to call you. If I see that resume and this resume looks like a qualified individual, then I'm going to call you. And if your resume does that, if your resume gets you in the door, it's done its job.
Mm. Good point.
Now, someone has been, let's say they've been out of work for more than a year. What do you do with your resume to make it more attractive? You know, that's a big hole, you know, in terms of time for someone to be out of work, and it's something that happens, you know. But how do you, what's the best way to handle that?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's a great question. And again, it boils down to structuring the resume in a way that it will highlight your strengths. And obviously, in this case, if you've been out of work for a year, your strength is not in the past year. So if you were, say, some hotshot professional football player who had a great career and then went into retirement for about a year, and then you showed up in my office and said, you know, I need a resume. I want to go back to work and get hired as a running back. Well, what I would talk about is not what you've been doing the past year, working as a sports commentator. Instead, what I would do is I would highlight your accomplishments as a running back, and I put that right at the top, and I wouldn't focus on the year that you've been out of the field. We'd focus on what you did in that field, and the chronology we would put lower down in the resume. So it's a matter of finding a way to structure your strengths. You know, you can talk about someone's experience in thousands of different ways. So a resume, while it may appear to be a pedestrian document, the way you structure the content, the way you talk about somebody's background can be as varied as telling any story whatsoever. So I would find a way to make sure we highlight the great achievements of this individual. If you've been out of work for a number of years, we'd find a way to talk about what you did when you were working and the skills that you have. And if you were out of work for a period of time, but you've been involved in some volunteer activities where those activities have taken advantage of your skills, then we'd find a way to talk about that activity closer to the top so that the strengths that are most important would be highlighted and be the first thing that the reader sees.
I like what you said about that. When someone, because I've got clients right now that have been out of a job for a year, year and a half, and I love the idea of doing, you know, do volunteer work because you're still working. You're still using your skill set. And I really haven't thought about that showing up on the resume as well. I think that's really good information for those people.
Absolutely. And frequently,
it's motivation.
Yeah, absolutely. And I urge my clients, if they're at the beginning of a job search and they've got some time to look around and to realize it may take a little time to find a job. And so what you do now is not irrelevant. If there's still an organization where you can volunteer your time and really apply your skills. If you're a financial officer of some sort, and you've been out of work for a year, well, if there's a nonprofit organization that could take advantage of your financial acumen, go ahead and do some volunteer work. We can put that right on your resume that you're doing it now, mm-hmm. and it's showcasing some of your skills. And so you immediately deal with the problem of what you're doing now on your resume. There's always a solution. You know, the key thing is not to be forlorn, even if you're having a tough time finding a job, even if you're a little down in the dumps, even if the job market is bad. There are always other methods you can try to improve your chances and to vary the kinds of activities you're doing to look for a job. So I urge people never to give up. You only need one job, after all, even if you haven't found it yet.
Right.
Now, Paul, you know, oftentimes we've heard and sometimes we've even seen written in books and so on, you know, giving advice on, you know, resume writing tips and so on. And one of those that I've seen quite a number of times is the idea that you should keep your statements, you know, to one or two sentences and keep things simple. And I know in your last response you'd mentioned, you know, even if possible, and I don't know exactly how you may have meant this, but telling a story or presenting an illustration.
Mm-hmm.
Did you mean by that something a little more lengthy than just a few sentences describe what your job experiences were and so on?
Well, the key thing is to show how you made a difference. That's always what matters. You don't want a resume that simply lists your job duties. That won't do, because that's what everybody can be expected to do. So if I'm hiring someone and I see another resume that simply lists what somebody did on their job, I'll know, well, this is what they were supposed to be doing. This is what their job description was. What I have to know, if I'm going to hire you, I have to know whether you made a difference in doing these things, whether the fact that you swept the floor neatly in the entryway, well, that was your job duty, but if you did such a good job that traffic into the business increased because prior to your sweeping the entryway, it was too dirty and people didn't like to come in. And if you can tell me, well, traffic increased by 20% and that increased sales by $25 a week, well, then that's going to be persuasive. So it's not a matter of how long the sentences are. I mean, if they can be short and sweet, as long as they're clear, crisp, and well-written, that's what matters. I need to be able to read it clearly. You need to make sure the resume looks professional, that it's well-designed, that the fonts are easy to read, that you're not futzing around with 25 different fonts on one single page with lots of different sizes, and you don't want every line to be bulleted. You just need it to look professional. It needs to be easy to read. You need to convey that you make a difference. And if you do that, your resume will serve its purpose. And when it does serve its purpose, you'll get an interview. And then you have a chance to really show people what you can do.
I think that's a great advice. Great advice. Never heard it put that way.
Yeah. And something I think a lot of people wonder about is the number of jobs or the employment history. I mean, how much history do you need to put on a resume, and how do they determine that? And, you know, because
mm-hmm.
you have that other factor of, well, my resume should probably be, you know, a page or is it two pages these days? So
mm-hmm.
how do you know how much to put on?
Again, there's a lot of so-called experts have weighed in on this, and you'll find articles all over the place. You'll have people who claim to be experts saying your resume has got to be one page, and it should never be more than one page. You have other experts saying your resume has got to be two pages, and it should never be more than two pages. I'm agnostic about this myself. I don't think that the hiring managers, the HR people, spend their time worrying about how many pages a resume is. They want the most qualified person. And mm-hmm. the important thing is that the resume, that as they look at it, it convinces them that you are qualified. So in terms of the number of pages, you know, honestly, I would say the average resume for someone who's been working for a number of years is usually going to be about 2 pages, because that gives you enough space to talk about several different jobs that somebody may have had over the course of a career. But in terms of how far back you go, typically nowadays there is a standard that I recommend, and that is going back not really further than about 10 years chronologically. There is justifiable concern about age discrimination, and unfortunately I see this often. There's nothing much we can do about it. We can't spend our time trying to prove that we didn't get a job because of our age. That would be pretty tough to prove. So what you need to do simply is develop a resume, and most people do. It goes back, at the most, about 10 years, so you're not giving away your age, and you do allow yourself to show sufficient experience. And as far as discussing things that you've done in your career maybe 15 years ago, that can still be done. There are still ways to do that on a resume without dating them, without specifying particular dates that you did things. So you provide a chronology to show that you've been working, to show that you're reliable, but there are ways to discuss other things as well on the document without dating everything. We do need to worry about age discrimination, and unfortunately, it does exist. So the number of pages, I wouldn't worry about so much. The number of years you go back, I go back about 10 to 12 years.
What about a CV? Do you write CVs for people as well?
I do. And the funny thing is CVs and resumes are really approaching each other in terms of what they are. Typically, CVs have been used more by academics. They're typically going to be longer documents. They're going to include research lists of papers that someone's written, et cetera. But more and more a resume is used even in the fields where CVs have been used in the past. But, yeah, I write CVs also for people who are, say, doctors or researchers.
You know, an organization wanted to bring me in recently, and they're – person setting this up for the speaker, they wanted my resume. Mm-hmm. And I kind of laughed. I kind of like, well, I've been doing this for 24 years out of college is all I've done. My website is my resume. You know,
mm-hmm.
I thought, well, I could put it into a CV format. That's going to be really long. I mean, you're talking 24 years of all these projects and stuff that I've done, the company's done. What would you say to someone like me who's out there, entrepreneurial? They want to do a resume. They want to put something or a bio. Maybe a bio would be better for them, for like on their website. What would you recommend them to have on file for something like that?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it can depend. You know, in your case, someone was asking you for it, so they might have had a standard kind of document that they had in mind. So in that mm-hmm. case, if a client asked me the question, I would say, you know, ask them if there's an example of what they have in mind. They're wanting to post your background on their website, and there are examples of other bios or other resumes that they've done from other people, and you can take a look at that and then try to match it, because you'd want yours to be consistent. But it does sound like this might be an instance where a short bio might be effective, and that's what they might have been looking for. And in that case, you write about a page or so to describe your career history in a short biographical fashion. You kind of imagine that you were running into an old friend you hadn't seen since high school, and your friend says, "So what have you been doing the last 20 years?" and you've got maybe 2 minutes to tell him. So you can't tell him every last detail. You need to figure out a way to highlight things and show off and show him how much you've accomplished.
Yeah, I feel like Dan said, a person can't do their own. You know, I think that's real key. I think people get so they try to do their own resumes. This is my experience with people that I've encountered. They try to do their own resumes. They spend so many hours, and wind up with something they don't like, and they could have paid someone professionally and got it done in 3 hours of time,
mm-hmm.
you know. And instead of spending 20 hours or 40 hours on it, I mean, how much is a person's time really worth? I think most people need to realize you need to pay somebody else to do that for you so you could be spending that time looking for a job.
Yeah, the funny thing is people are not used to writing a resume. It's not something we do very often. When you're faced with an expense that you're not used to, people are sometimes shocked. Oh, I should spend a few hundred dollars on a resume. Well, you know, if you have a good resume, it's likely to. Think of a resume as one of the few documents that can really improve your career trajectory. Not just now, not just helping you get a job sooner. And if a resume could. Oh, if it's the only thing it did was help you find a job 2 weeks sooner, it would already pay for itself.
That's my point.
But if it helped you find a job that puts you on a better career path, not only will it help you get a salary sooner, but it'll help you get a raise sooner. It'll help you find a better job 5 years from now sooner. So ultimately, it just can have a tremendous impact.
Very, very good point. I think the listeners need to get to understand that. It's not. Don't be cheap about it because it's the best money you'll spend because of the time you save. Like you said, get a better position. If the resume is written better, you might get a better position and better salary.
Mm-hmm. I certainly think so.
Yeah.
Now, Paul, we've all heard of the the functional resume, the chronological resume, and then this other hybrid resume called a combination resume. Could you tell us, what all of these mean, and when is it appropriate to use one or the other?
Sure. A resume is a story. It's a story about a person, and there are lots and lots of ways to tell a story. And so what I try to do when I'm developing your resume is to figure out what's going to make for the most compelling story, a story that will get you an interview. Now, if you have had a successful career where you've been employed nonstop in great companies, it's clear cut. We would write a chronological resume that would be organized in reverse chronological order because most often, a prospective company that's looking to hire you would like to know what you've been doing lately. And so you want to put that early on in the document, and that's straightforward. Again, of course, highlighting accomplishments in each case. But, it's just a fact that most of us have not had careers that are that linear, that clear-cut. Many of us have had breaks during our career. We've done different things. We've had ebbs and flows of times where we've had a better job than in other times. And perhaps my best job was 10 years ago. Perhaps I have not been working for the past year. In that case, a chronological resume might not serve you as well. And then we can think about a functional resume or something along those lines where I don't organize it specifically in reverse chronological order. Instead, I might focus on the different areas that you've worked in. If you're going for a job as a computer programmer, and 10 years ago you worked as a computer programmer for a couple of years and you never did it again, then I would still manage to get that at the top. Now, we wouldn't put the chronology right there, but we would talk about your computer program experience, and we would describe it in detail and show how you made a difference as a computer programmer. We wouldn't put the dates there. We'd put the dates and list the dates probably down at the bottom. So we'd find a way still to get your most salient accomplishments near the top, because that's what you want. That's what you want people to see first. That's what you want them to think about when they see your name on the page, and that's what you want them to be aware of so that they will call you in for an interview. Once you can get a foot in the door, the fact that maybe you've been out of work, you can overcome that during a job interview if you've prepared well.
Well, I want to ask you a quick question. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Dan.
No, I'm fine. Go ahead.
Well, just when you said, you mentioned earlier in a couple of your questions back, you said about the keywords on top or words on top or verbiage on the top. On the very top of a resume, do you suggest that people change that heading or banner or promo, whatever that is on the top, summary, according to the job they're going for, or do you consistently keep it the same all the time?
Mm-hmm. Well, I try to write a resume so that it clearly addresses the most likely job target for mm-hmm. my client. So if you are a football running back with great success, then the resume would say, professional running back with years of success as NFL leader in yards gained. And that's mm-hmm. clearly going to address what you've done and what you're good at. But let's just say that there are no running back positions available, but there is a position available as a linebacker. And maybe you played linebacker in high school and you're willing to try to go for that job as well. We could very easily change the headline of the resume to read something along the lines of accomplished football player with diverse experience on both sides of the line. And so there are ways to phrase things to tackle the job, no pun intended, the job that you're really going for. So there are usually ways to deal with it, and so it's a good idea to pay attention to each job that you're applying for, take a look at the resume, and see if it might make sense to tweak the resume just a bit so that it stands out for that particular employer.
I think the key thing is for people to know is that the basic resume is there. You can make minor adjustments on your own. You just need a good foundation to start with.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's worth paying attention, as each employer may have slightly different needs. You know, even if you're applying for a job as a lead singer in a rock and roll band, and you mostly have training in opera, then your resume said that you were an opera tenor at the top of the resume and you were applying for this rock band singing job, you probably changed the headline to say talented lead singer as opposed to mentioning anything about the opera. It's always possible to tweak it a little bit.
Right. Good point. Very good point.
And, Paul, what advice do you have for someone who's thinking about maybe who thinks it's a good idea to attach references to the resume to make it easier for that employer to say, hey, well, you know what, let me just go ahead and give a call to this person and find out what kind of employee they were, you know, what were they like, or to just confirm their employment dates and all that. Is it a good idea to attach references to your resume?
I'm glad you asked that, because the issue of references comes up a lot, and it's because for many, many years, the standard was to put on the resume references available upon request. And people always put that on the resume, but don't do that anymore. It shows that you haven't been thinking about how to properly do a resume. It's simply not done anymore. The reason for that is that companies know that they can ask for references. They don't need to be told by you on your resume that references are available upon request. So what I typically suggest is don't put them on the resume unless specifically the company has asked for a reference sheet. Now, what I do suggest is make sure you do have references so that if a potential employer asks you for references, that you can quickly get them to them. You can either email them, you can tell them, oh, I'm happy to follow up with references, I'll email it to you. Or if you go in for an interview, you might carry a reference list in your briefcase. And if they mention, you know, we'd love to get some references, you can say, oh, I happen to have a reference list right here, and you can pull it out and hand it to them. So you just want to make sure that you have checked in with some folks who are willing to be references for you, so that you don't have to worry about it subsequently.
Great idea. Well, it looks like we're all out of time, but I want to make sure that people know how to get a hold of you, Paul, if they got more questions about resume or having you create their resume for them. So if you can give them your contact information, your website address, and anything else,
sure,
you think would be good.
Well, I appreciate that. I would love to hear from people who would like the opportunity of getting a great resume that can really help them in their job search. And they can check me out on my website at www.shimmeringresumes.com. That's resumes plural, so www.shimmeringresumes.com. And there's a toll-free number right on the website. They can call me if they have questions. They can also email me through the website. There's an info box right there, or they can feel free to go ahead and send an email if they like to paul@shimmeringresumes.com.
Absolutely wonderful. Great show. We were so happy to have you on, Paul. And,
all right. Thank you.
Paul,
and I enjoy your guys. Mm-hmm. I think it's so important that you guys are talking about image. It's really, really valuable.
Oh, great.
Thank you, Paul. It's
and
a pleasure to meet you.
And if it's possible, Paul, we'd love to have you back, you know, for a follow-up show.
Okay. Well, I'd love to do that.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Paul.
Okay. Take
bye,
care, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
The Art of Image was sponsored by L.T. Bodrix of San Francisco. I'm Dan Phillips.